I'll just take 30 seconds before I begin. I want to acknowledge Ference Szabo, our organizer for this, who last summer very graciously accepted my invitation for him to go into the libraries here and find some newspaper reviews for me in the Hungarian language press and send those to me. If he hadn't done that, I wouldn't be able to have written this paper, so I'm very grateful for that. On January 2nd, 1915, during the first winter of the First World War, the celebrated composer Karl Rundmark died in Vienna at the ripe old age of 84. The Viennese press gave the story of his passing the kind of coverage that one would expect for a figure who was described as the rector of Austrian music, even its epicenter. The notice in the Neue Freie Presse was particularly striking in its imagery. We, musical Vienna and the entire musical world, stand shaken around the funeral bier of the great composer and Austrian, Karl Rundmark. As the report goes on, we find a clear reference to the war effort. Many of our best and brightest must now die on the battlefield for the fatherland. Rundmark lived for his fatherland, and by creating art touched by the breath of eternity, he honored the fatherland in his own way and greatly increased the cultural heritage of humanity. Meanwhile, in the other great capital of the dual monarchy, the composer's death was covered very differently. To read the obituaries that appeared in Budapest is to be told that Hungary, not Austria, was Rundmark's fatherland. Here, in effect, both halves of the monarchy were fighting over the same man's legacy. The former, on the basis of his Hungarian birth and childhood, the latter, on the basis of his long residency in Austria and the central role he played in the musical culture of late Habsburg Vienna. I will leave the Viennese obituaries aside now and focus on those that appeared in Budapest. The city's German language, Pesterloid, began the biographical portion of its story with a clear indication that here was a life that had followed the traditional path for ambitious Hungarian-born Jews of Rundmark's generation to assimilate into German culture. Yet this writer closed by emphasizing that Rundmark had always spoken warmly and with an open heart about the land of his birth, and significantly proclaimed him a powerful builder in the a powerful pillar in the building of Hungary's artistic fame. Most of the obituaries that appeared in the Budapest's Hungarian language press likewise took note of Rundmark's Jewish heritage, but only in passing and without placing any particular emphasis on it. It was the composer's relation to his Hungarian homeland, not his religious heritage, that seemed to matter. The notice published in the Pesti Napo, Pest Journal, is particularly instructive. In a single sentence, the author characterizes Rundmark as both Hungarian and one of the greatest talents of modern music. The obituarist acknowledges that the composer chose to make his life and career in Vienna, but insists that he loved his native country and would have remained there if only circumstances had been more favorable to him. Proper recognition by the nationalist elites, the writer tells us, came only later, after Rundmark had become famous. And even then, his genius was not always fully appreciated in official circles. But if prejudicial attitudes and powerful corners had once been very real, the writer nevertheless ends on a hopeful note. Quote, "All this belongs to the past. We musicians do not want to use this time of mourning for reproaches. We express our hope that the master will at least be appropriately honored after his death, and his earthly remains will find a final resting place in national soil." Quote. In the event, Rundmark was laid to rest a few days later in a memorial grave in the Jewish section of Vienna's Central Cemetery. Notably, the Royal Hungarian Opera sent a representative to the funeral. Pointedly speaking in Hungarian amongst all the German speakers, the tenor Franz von Szekely eulogized Rundmark as Hungary's greatest composer. It's as though the singer were saying, "This great man's mortal remains may come to rest here in Austria, but he will always be one of us, Hungarian." From this point forward, and especially for reasons that I don't have time to explore today, onward from 1930, the centenary of the composer's birth, Rundmark's supposed Magyarság, his Hungarianness, has been celebrated as a matter of national pride. It had not always been this way. as suggested in the obituary that appeared in the Pesti Napolo, as well as in other Hungarian obituaries not quoted here, the most fervent Magyar nationalists had looked upon Goldmark with suspicion in the years before he became a truly international figure. Doubts about the composer's Hungarian credentials can be traced back at least to the period following Francis Joseph's acceptance in May 1867 of the Austro-Hungarian Compromise, which dissolved the Austrian Empire and created in its place two largely separate constitutional monarchies in Austria and Hungary. Earlier, the Austrian Ministry of Education, which had jurisdiction over the entire Habsburg realm in the pre-compromise era, had awarded Goldmark two stipends in support of the composition of his opera Die Königin von Saba. But in the new post-compromise era, the composer was no longer eligible for Austrian state support, despite his longtime Viennese residency, since he was now, strictly speaking, a foreigner living in the Austrian half of the dual monarchy. For additional support of his still unfinished opera, he turned instead to the newly established Hungarian Ministry of Education. The news that Goldmark had been successful in his application did not go over well with the ethno-nationalist Vasárnapi Újság Sunday News. Quote, "That the Minister of Education is championing the tender cause of our artistic production has met with general approval. Only the assistance given to Mr. Goldmark has been censured. He is said to be a talented composer, but not exactly Hungarian. The circumstance that he happens to have been born here does not make him Hungarian, and one doesn't understand how a Viennese German composer may receive Hungarian state support." In what follows, I would advance one plausible explanation for why this Viennese German composer eventually came to be seen as a great Hungarian one. This will involve considering Goldmark's social identity as a category of belonging imposed from the outside by various Hungarian elites. There is another side to the coin, however, and toward the end, I'll discuss Goldmark's social identity as he perceived it himself, what we might think of as his self-perception or subjectivity. Thus, the subtitle of my talk, How Hungarian Was Goldmark? The multinational composition of the lands of the Crown of St. Stephen, as the Hungarian half of the dual monarchy was officially known, included, of course, Magyars, that is, Hungarians in the ethnic sense, who formed a plurality of the population, along with sizable numbers of Slovaks, Germans, Romanians, Croats, Serbs, and Ruthenes. For much of its history, Latin served as Hungary's official language, used by the large nobility that had traditionally composed the so-called Nacio Hungarica. When in 1784 the Habsburg monarch Joseph II replaced Latin with German as the official language, the nobility rebelled, seeing this not as a means of making the bureaucracy more efficient, but as a Germanizing attack on the quasi-sovereignty that the Hungarian lands had always enjoyed since becoming a part of the Habsburg monarchy in 1526. 5 years later, on his deathbed, Joseph rescinded this controversial order and Latin was made once more the official language. Not until 1844 did Hungarian fully replace Latin as the official language. Although many nobles, even some of those with Magyar roots, could not in fact speak Hungarian fluently, they saw its adoption as the official language as the best strategy for minimizing ties with the German-speaking Habsburg monarchy. In this way, as Barbara Trinkvist-Pleve has argued, the birth and history of the Hungarian state was linked to a Magyar identity. This new idea of a Magyar Nemzet, the Hungarian nation, finally came into being as a result of the Austro-Hungarian Compromise in 1867. Unlike the older Nacio Hungarica, this was envisioned to unite everyone who resided within historic Hungary, irrespective not only of nationality, but also of social class or religion, through a common Hungarian culture and language. To be sure, all national groups were given the right by law to maintain their own cultures and languages within the overall framework of the Magyar state, but the more hard-minded ethno-nationalists, whose views ultimately carried the day in the post-compromise era, rejected this super-ethnic state-nation approach and aimed instead to build a linguistically and ethnically similar nation-state. Toward this end, they were abetted by a linguistic ambiguity. In Hungarian, the word magyar is used to express two very different conceptions of belonging, both the broad category based on territorial boundaries, what in German is called Ungar, in English Hungarian, and the narrow one that referred to members of Hungary's largest, but by no means majority group, called Magyars, in both German and English, as well as in Hungarian. This semantic imprecision made it easy for the ethno-nationalists to conflate Magyar ethnicity with membership in the united Hungarian nation. Thus, they continued to deal with the country's non-Hungarian peoples as they had done in the past, by attempting to make Hungarians of them, that is, encouraging them to assimilate or acculturate as Magyars. Socially ambitious Jews who were born after Goldmark's time were receptive to this call, rightly sensing that their best interests now lay with the rising Magyar elites. An aspiring painter named Mikhail Lieb offers a case in point. During the 1860s, this young artist of Jewish heritage Magyarized his name to Mihály Munkácsy, and eventually became celebrated as one of Hungary's greatest painters, despite making his career abroad. Munkácsy was among the group of artists and musicians who, along with Goldmark, received Hungarian state support in 1869. But as a Magyarized Jew, he, unlike the Germanized Jew, Goldmark, received no censure from the ethno-nationalists. The somewhat older German-speaking composer was already a popular favorite in Budapest, as suggested by the Budapest Philharmonic's performances of the overture Sakuntala in each of the two previous seasons. Already then, the ethno-nationalists must have sensed that Goldmark would not become the Hungarian equivalent of his contemporary Peter Smetana, the native German-speaking Bohemian composer who, after living abroad, returned to Prague in the early 1860s, taught himself to speak Czech, and assumed the mantle of a Czech nationalist. And unlike Franz Liszt, who had also left Hungary at an early age and never learned to speak proper Hungarian, the up-and-coming Goldmark showed no signs of cultivating a Magyar identity. The composer thus may well have been considered a small threat to the ethno-nationalists' cultural project of consolidating a purely Magyar centralist state. Nationalist attitudes toward Goldmark finally began to soften at the Fendi-Sziget. By now, the city of Budapest had become a distinctly Hungarian place, the proud, confident capital of a multinational state in which Magyars were inevitably achieving majority status. It was this Magyar Budapest that honored the composer in February 1895 with the three-day Goldmark Festival, capped by a large banquet following the concluding concert by the Budapest Philharmonic. The guest of honor began his dinner remarks by assuring those in attendance that although he could not speak Hungarian, he was a true son of the fatherland. After all, he continued, here is found the grave of my parents. Here I spent my childhood. Here is a mature man I have been appreciated, and these bonds can never be severed. The composer concluded by noting the enthusiasm for music in evidence at the opera, the Music Academy, the Chamber Music Societies, and the Philharmonic, and gave his best wishes for the continued strength and health of the city's musical life in the future. Notably, Goldmark said nothing to suggest solidarity with a Magyar Nemzet. The connections he described were limited to the realms of the familial and personal. Yet the event itself was suffused with nationalist sentiment. In written remarks read aloud in his absence, Minister of Education, Gyula Vlasics, paid tribute, quote, to the genius of the great master and the highest flight of fancy of the Hungarian composer, whose eternal works bring adornment to our fatherland and the entire world, end quote. Count Albert Apponyi spoke approvingly of the minister's support of these Goldmark days, as he called them, which he saw as entirely fitting and in keeping with the ministry's calling to support the nation's arts. He praised the Philharmonic players for the part they had played in this enhancement of Hungary's, quote, musical, cultural, and national life, end quote. Then switching to German in order to address Goldmark directly, Apponyi offered the composer his thanks and deep admiration, He described the festival as a time in which the public had enjoyed the purest elevation, and on behalf of that public, implicitly on behalf of the entire Magyar Nemzet, he concluded with the hope that the composer might long live in our hearts and minds. Bleibe uns lange erhalten. It suggested that Goldmark's reputation in the estimation of the Magyar elites began to improve as the country was entering the golden age of its millennium. The reference here is to the year of commemoration that took place in 1896 to mark the 1000th anniversary of the Magyar's arrival into the Carpathian Valley. Signs of Hungarian self-confidence were evident everywhere from Budapest, which celebrated by hosting the Millennium Exhibition in the city park. Monumental structures were inaugurated throughout the city. Across from the park's entrance was the new Heroes Square, constructed at the end of the recently completed Andrássy út, the Champs-Élysées of Budapest, as it's been called, under which was opened continental Europe's first underground railroad. Located nearby was the new Hall of Art, and along the Danube, the central section of the Parliament building, the largest in the world, was completed, and there were new bridges spanning the river as well. It was in this dynamic environment that Goldmark was now presented to the world as a kind of living monument of the Hungarian nation. His international fame seemed to trump his lack of genuine Magyar credentials. After all, the ethno-nationalists could now reap the benefits of association with Goldmark's considerable cultural prestige at the international level, at no risk to their by now fully secure national project, on proud display at the end of the century for the entire world to see. Before long, music critics in Budapest began to discover latent or unconscious Hungarian influence throughout Goldmark's oeuvre, even in the most unlikely of suspects, such as the opera Merlin that Richard was talking about earlier today. This steadily intensifying appropriation of Goldmark for Hungary reached a peak in May 1910, when the composer's 80th birthday was marked in, among many ways, with a nationalist-infused celebration held in his honor in his birthplace of Kestve, a small town along the shores of Lake Balaton. In the public comments he made on this occasion, Goldmark sidestepped the national question just as he had done at the Goldmark Festival held in Budapest 15 years earlier. He began by sharing memories of the hometown that he had not visited since leaving as a boy of four, the house of his birth, the street on which it was located, the banks of the Plattensee, as Lake Balaton is known in German, and then of all things, the terrifying day when he was sent to the doctor to be vaccinated against smallpox. After commenting that this homecoming day after 76 years counted among the most joyful, joyous, and beautiful in his long life, he concluded with a toast to the health of his hometown and its people. Auf das Wohl der Heimat und ihrer Bevölkerung. The word Heimat, a particularly German concept, has no direct semantic equivalent in other languages. It can refer to one's native country, but more typically is used to refer to one's native region, a village or town, for example, often together with its associated landscape, customs, traditions, and so forth. And it was in this more narrow sense, I believe, that Goldmark made use of the term in Kestve. Yet Heimat can also be any place where one has planted deep roots or feels at home for whatever reason. However it is used, the word tends to express an emotional bond and seems to have little or nothing to do with national identity. In other words, Goldmark's notion of Heimat almost certainly did not imply the Hungarian nation. When Goldmark made these remarks, he was setting to work in his memoirs, and here again he invoked the idea of Heimat, albeit with a wider range of meanings than before. The passage in question was prompted by his retelling of the day in the early 1860s when, for the first time in many years, he paid a visit to Deutschkreuz, the small town where he grew up from the age of four. The recollection of this episode some 50 years later prompted Goldmark in his memoirs to reflect in a telling way on the matter of his self-perception. And this is a little bit of a longer quotation. The Hungarian newspapers have frequently denied me not only my rights of domicile, Heimatsrechte, but also my emotional attachment to the place of my birth, Heimatsgefühle, because I do not speak Hungarian and have lived for so long outside the country. Indeed, I've lived for 67 years in Vienna, have educated myself from German sources in science and art, and in this sense count myself among the Germans. I love this, my second home of growth and development, zweite Heimat des Wachsens und Werdens, to which I owe everything that I am and stand for. But all that has not extinguished my strong, deeply rooted emotional attachment to the place of my birth, Heimatsgefühle. Only a man with a heart of stone would fail to hold dear the soil in which his cradle stood and all the sweet reflections of childhood. In this sense, I remain true to the place of my birth, Geburtsheimat. Of this passage is many references to Heimat. The first stands apart from the others in that it refers to a concrete legal principle. In citizenship law, in both halves of the dual monarchy, Heimatrecht denoted the right to reside in a particular municipality, often but not always the place of birth, and to be entitled to poor relief by its public authorities in case of need. As it happens, extant official documents give conflicting evidence on the question of where Goldmark was heimisch, whether in Keste or Nimitkeister, as Deutschkreuz is known in Hungarian. Whatever the explanation for this discrepancy, it is clear that Goldmark felt a similar emotional bond, warm Heimatsgefühle, for both his birthplace and his boyhood home. But this made Goldmark a proud Ungar, not a Magyar. And despite all those recent claims in Budapest of latent or unconscious Hungarian influences in his music, his cultural roots spring from German soil. I wrote German music, as he explained in the pages of the Neue Freie Presse in 1911, just at the same time he was writing his memoirs. That is proved by all my chamber and orchestra works, as well as by all my operas. He then goes on to add that he not only had lived among Germans since childhood, but owed his entire artistic Bildung to German art. What is this, if not a proud co-opting of the critical remark made about him 42 years earlier, when he was dismissed as a Viennese German composer who ought not to be eligible for Hungarian state support, for Heimatrecht in Hungary, so to speak. The Austrian capital may not have been Goldmark's Geburtsheimat, that clearly lay to the east in Hungary. But from an early age, Vienna had become his zweite Heimat, his second home, the one to which as a gebildet man and composer, he owed everything that he was and stood for. Thank you.